Good morning, church. How many people are visiting with us here this morning for the first time? For the second time? I guess the reason I'm asking, I just want to clearly establish I'm not the regular guy. Tough shoes to fill for myself, for Dion being gone. I would like to ask, again, to keep them and everyone else that's at Winterfest in Tennessee this weekend, traveling to pray for them and be with their safety as they're coming back. We have a wonderful congregation here if you are visiting. Lots of people that love and encourage one another, as I know everyone will love and encourage me this morning, even if I ramble on for 45, 50 minutes. Right? Okay. Well, we are going through the Bible. We are through Joshua now. We've also picked up Job. So if you happen to be keeping track like myself, we're about 20%, a little tad short of 20% through the Bible. So I really encourage you to continue with this. If you've maybe fallen off a little bit, get back on. It's not that too late to join. And frankly, being able to go through this with everyone in the church has been a great blessing. I think it's opened up doors to people on the outside to see that we're founded in the Bible. And I think everyone is getting a blessing from it. So I want to take us back in history a little bit. It's shortly before 5 o'clock in the afternoon on April 12, 1945. President Roosevelt has just died. He suffered a major cerebral hemorrhage, and the world is shocked. It takes about an hour for the news to get out. And you think about it, the man who's been a president now, who's been in the Oval Office for 12 years, is dead. Mixed results throughout the world. Most people think it's going to be a major turning point in the war. In Germany and Japan, of course, they're thinking it's going to be a positive turning point for them. Many of the world's going to think, you know, would that kind of prediction be correct? For suddenly now, Harry Truman is our president. Most people had no idea who he was. He'd been in office for 82 days as vice president. Different from Roosevelt, who had been in office for 12 years. No one really knew him. He was vastly untested. Pretty much the only thing people knew about him was he was an uneducated haberdasher from Independence, Missouri. Hadn't really had any type of tests that he had to be involved with in the White House, especially on the world stage. And certainly he hadn't been tested in the midst of World War II. Donald McCullough is a biographer that wrote a book about Truman. And he quoted in there saying, you know, Truman had no experience in foreign relations, didn't know Churchill, Stalin, didn't even know his own Secretary of State. In fact, many thought he was kind of in the blind about even a whisper of having a nuclear bomb that was being developed at the time. And above all, he wasn't Franklin Roosevelt, the president that we had all had grown to love and trusted and had confidence in as a leader. Upon hearing that President Roosevelt had passed, Harry Truman went to go visit with Eleanor Roosevelt, and he was stunned. And he passed on to Eleanor. He said, "Is there anything I can do for you?" And of course, Eleanor Roosevelt turns to him and say, "We should be asking the same thing. What can we do for you? For you're the one that's in trouble now." And so he was. Of course, we have the luxury of looking back in history and knowing that Harry Truman did just fine. In fact, he successfully led our country through the end of World War II. But it was very scary and very uncertain. We, of course, had the whole the Nazi menace in Europe. The Pacific War against Japan was becoming very bloody. And everyone now, without Roosevelt there, was very concerned. What would be next? Well, it's a great question because the book of Joshua opens up with a similar question. If you look at the very first words, verse 1, chapter 1, read the first few words and let that sink in. After the death of Moses. After the death of Moses. Moses is dead. It's very hard, I mean, in this point in history for Israel, for them to know that the same guy that came and rescued them from Egypt, led them into the wilderness, the same person that was the mouthpiece for God, was in God's presence in Sinai, created the Ten Commandments, and then, of course, successfully led them through the wilderness for 40 years. He was gone. So of course they had a lot of questions. How would God speak to them? Would they speak? Would he still speak to them without Moses being there? Would anyone else care for them, protect them, shield them? All questions that must have gripped the Israelites each and every day following his death. God comes right out of the gates, though, in Joshua and establishes two things right off the bat. First, clear instructions and expectations for Israel and for Joshua. And two, overwhelming encouragement for Joshua. You know, Moses may be dead, but really the last thing that Moses would have wanted or God wanted at that point in time for them is to just sit around and feeling sorry for themselves. You can almost hear him coming out saying, hey, you've got a rivet across. Get on it. You can really feel that coming across. Even in verse 3, he reassures them everything he promised to Moses is in effect for Joshua. He elevates Joshua and says, he's your leader. Most importantly, everything that's stuck before is sticking now. And so in an instant, God wipes away all of their uncertainty. So that's good for Israel. But think about Joshua. He's the one that needs encouragement now. He knows that he's the one that probably needs reassurance more than anyone. He's been following Moses. He's been with him the whole time, but now he's the guy. For Joshua was the one who's in trouble now. And the people that are following Joshua, they're caught between a rock and a hard place. They could turn around. They got the vast chaotic nature of the wilderness behind them that they've survived now for 40 years, which they don't want to go back to. They're faced with a land of Canaan, a very well-established Canaan, cities that are well-fortified, armies that are very well-trained. The amount of combat experience that Israel has at that point in time, very small. So yes, the odds are stacked up against them. And of course, I'm quite certain Joshua needs some reassurance. So if you go through that, you know, God does assure Joshua. And I so many times when you read through this, and I'm starting in chapter 1, verse 6 through 9. Be strong and courageous, because you will lead these people to inherit the land I swore to their forefathers to give them. Be strong and very courageous. Be careful to obey all the law my servant Moses gave you. Do not turn from it right or left, that you may be successful wherever you go. Do not let this book of the law depart from your mouth. Meditate on it day and night so that you may be careful to do everything written in it. Then you will be prosperous and successful. Have I not commanded you? Be strong and courageous. Do not be terrified. Do not be discouraged, for the Lord your God will be with you wherever you go. No less than 8 times in 4 verses, God reassures Joshua. He tells him, I will be with you. Be strong and be courageous. He's trying to fill him with confidence and trying to get him thinking about expect success. You're going to have success because I am with you. And it's a small wonder you think about it. Joshua in verse 10, he gets up, he takes charge. Man, he is my kind of guy. I've always said in the opportunities that I've had to lead the teams that I've been with, probably the 3 most cherished words I want to hear from anyone on that team is, I got it. Basically, the ability to step forward, take accountability, take responsibility, and get in it. And that's what Joshua did. He sat there, pulled his officers together. He said, hey, in 3 days, we're crossing this river. We're going to follow God, and that's where we're heading. So get ready. And what did the people say? They gave him tremendous encouragement and support also. They give him a pledge of allegiance, and they also tell him, be strong and be courageous, for we're following you. And I think what a powerful lesson for all of us, whether it's within the church, when we think about the leaders of our church, our elders, and our deacons and the people that are serving, so many times we need to offer that same type of encouragement, that same type of support. Think about the leaders out in our community. So many times all they're hearing is, why isn't this happening? Why aren't we doing this? When really all they need to hear is, what do you need? How can I help? And so it's a powerful lesson for us to see how Israel also gives Joshua that same level of support. So now from there, the amazing story begins, and it is a saga going through Joshua. You know, chapters 1 through 12 describe how Israel conquers the land. They're led by the Ark of the Covenant, crossing the Jordan River. The river stops. They can go through, and how kind of a fitting way to end this portion of the story, because the descendants of Israel had to do the same thing coming across in the Exodus of Egypt in crossing the Red Sea. And of course, we know that the battles that pursue, first over Jericho, and very systematic, very organized approach surrounding the city, 6 days, trumpets blaring, people yelling, tell me the people in Jericho were not absolutely going out of their heads at this point in time. Reputation preceded Israel. Everyone kind of knew the power that was behind them. Of course, then we also know they quickly establish a threshold in Jericho, and then they proceed to Ai, and they run into some problems. We quickly learn that the obedience to God on behalf of Israel is absolute and it's total. We learn about a person in the Israelite army by the name of Achan, who decides to keep some of the plunder for himself, the gold bars and the silver bars, and that broke the covenant, or that broke the promise that God had established with them, and all of a sudden we realize that they're being defeated by Ai. Joshua is discouraged. He doesn't understand it, but then they have to come and reconcile Achan. Everything seems to work out. They go back to Ai. They have a massive ambush set up, and they take over Ai. And really, when you think about it, they're successful on many fronts, but even from the perspective of military strategy, you have to respect the thought process that went into this. Completely divided northern versus the southern portions of Israel. They took the center portion to divide it up, and then they proceeded to go north-south as they went through all of Israel and claim the land that God had promised them for all this time. Now, thinking about this aspect of the warfare that's in Joshua, I will openly confess that, as with many of you, it was kind of difficult as far as seeing the totality of warfare and God's judgment upon these cities and total destruction. It was utter annihilation. And I struggled with it a little bit, thinking about, wait a minute, is this the same God of my Jesus in the New Testament that I'm reading about right now? And I started thinking about that this week. I said, Lord, help me with this, because I'm not sure exactly how to present this. And I'm not an expert in this topic. I'll be open to confess. But I do know that God's judgment is not a pretty subject, and it's not one that I wish to be subject to without Jesus, my Savior, with me. And I think in terms of, that's what one of the first things that, the first Joshua and the second Joshua, which, remember, Jesus is the Greek form of Joshua, had in common. We know that they remind us that our sin and God's redemption of our sin are gravely serious matters. We know that the holiness or the lack of holiness in Canaan was detestable to God. We read about that all through the Pentateuch. And at the end of the day, I know that the Jesus that I believe in is an exact representation of my God. And I know that in the end, I'm okay with it. And I share that with you personally. I say I'm okay with it because I know that our God and our Savior has a divine plan that I can't even begin to possibly understand. And I have trust, and I trust and I have faith in that, and that, you know what? I serve Jesus, our Savior, and I'm not going to understand that. So I think in that aspect, I was okay with it. But it was difficult. I realized that, and I know for many of you, it was also difficult. If we go forward then in chapters 13 through 22, we see how the 12 nations are divided up, very similar to the United States, divided into 12 different areas. And the book concludes with a covenant renewal by Joshua as he is now grown very old. And he encourages the people. And he starts it off with a phrase right from chapter 1, what God told him in chapter 23, verse 6. He also tells them, be very strong, be careful to obey all that is written in the book of the law of Moses without turning aside to the right or the left. So that's a quick summary of Joshua. And boy, it's not fair. There are so many deep and rich topics in there to explore, and just not enough time for me to talk this morning about that. But plenty of time for us to read and meditate on it, as individuals and as Christians serving one Lord. For the Israelites who first read this book, it was a pastoral comfort for them, just as it can be a comfort for us. The concept or the phrase of be strong and courageous resonates well with us right now. It can help those of us who are, you know, maybe facing an uncertain future in our careers, maybe are dealing with some type of chronic illness or disease amongst ourselves or with our family, or a whole host of similar frightening circumstances that we can be exposed to right now. And it's amazing how, in the whole sweep of this, it still comes down to Jesus' great commission to us. When you think about what he said, he said, "Behold, I'm with you always, even to the end of the age." That was Jesus' way of telling us, hey, be strong and courageous. I will never leave you. So for me, it resonates very well between Joshua's example of leadership and, of course, Jesus as our Savior. So it's a great encouragement for all of us. So, of course, the question that may come to your mind is, Kent, where's the application for us? As a church, and you think about it, you know, we're not leading 3 million people into battle, trying to conquer a well-fortified and established land. In fact, we're sitting here this morning in nice, comfortable pews. We're amongst brothers and sisters, people that love us, who are in God's presence. Probably wasn't much courage involved with making the decision to come here this morning. However, I think our challenge is when we leave these doors and go out into the world, and we spend most of our time there. And I've always said it's always easy to demonstrate that Sunday morning faith when we're here amongst people that we're kind of in a comfortable zone, but as soon as we leave, that's where Satan can be. That's where many of the challenges that we can run into can truly offer up challenges for us and require courage on our part. Just look around. It's all around us. We have people that are either have lost their jobs or struggling to keep their jobs, the security of their jobs going forward. You know, all the stuff we're hearing about recession versus depression, financial Armageddon, I'm so overwhelmed and tired of hearing it all because it just sets a feeling of fear. Many of us right here in this church battling with illness. Many of us dealing with things that require tremendous courage. I think about our kids, and when I think about the importance of what this committee at the church is doing and looking for a youth minister, because we have a group of teenagers and kids growing into be teenagers that are surrounded by a world of temptation and a world that's demanding conformance on their part. And Lord be with them, they need courage. And same with us. Everything that we're faced with in the world, issues of matters of the heart, when people challenge us in our belief, we need courage. How about the employee performance issue at work? Someone who you need to address, but you have a fear of confrontation. You need courage. So we know and we will admit that we all need courage, but how do you get it? That's the other phase of this lesson today. You know, while we all want it, we're stumped as to how to acquire it. Just a quotation from Winston Churchill. Again, this is a whole 1940s theme, I guess, this morning. Winston Churchill once said, "Courage is rightly esteemed the first of human qualities because it is the quality that guarantees all others." Eleanor Roosevelt also said, "You gain strength, courage, and confidence by every experience in which you really stop to look fear in the face. You're able to say to yourself, 'I live through this horror. I can take the next thing that comes along,' and then this is the phrase I want you to meditate on, 'You must do the thing you think you cannot do.'" John Maxwell, one of my favorite authors, wrote a book several years ago, The 21 Indispensable Qualities of a Leader, and it's a great book because he talks about intangible qualities of things you can do each and every day, and when he talks about courage, one of the things that he really stresses is face the music. If you really want to be courageous, think about the things in your life that maybe you're afraid to do. Do something that stretches you a little bit, gets you outside of your comfort zone. Speak in front of an audience. Skydive. Anyone that skydive here? Okay. Oh, Joshua's raising his hand. Okay. You want to skydive, but you haven't. Rock climbing. I don't know, maybe squash a bunch of grapes in a tin with your spouse. That actually happened several weeks ago. You would have had to have been at that party here at the church. So many different ways. And I see it all the time. I see things here going on at this church. I saw David last week lead the thoughts of the table very well. And he admitted it was the first time he was doing it. And he did a great job. And I really, that's a blessing to me to see people step up like that. I see it all the time. You know, I see Joe coming back, who's been serving us in Iraq, and it's so great to see him. But, you know, I really admire his courage and everyone else that serves our country in times of war. So I think it's one of those things that we really have to give ourselves an opportunity to be courageous. There was a movie a few years ago called Evan Almighty. And in that, Morgan Freeman, one of my favorite actors, he was actually playing the part of God, and he was having a discussion with Evan, because Evan was asking him about prayer and how he's answering prayer. And the quotation from Morgan Freeman, the actor, I could picture God saying something like this: "If someone prays for patience, do you think God gives them patience? Or does he give them the opportunity to be patient? If they pray for courage, does God give them courage, or does he give them the opportunity to be courageous? If someone prayed for their family to be closer, do you think God gives them, zaps them with warm, fuzzy feelings, or does he give them the opportunity to love each other?" So I say that right now because when I think many of us might be in fear, many of us might be in a circumstance that's creating anxiety that we're not certain about, that we require courage. It could be a broken relationship. It could be a temptation that has a very strong hold on us. Be strong and courageous. Just as God is with Joshua, he is also with us. Perhaps you're here this morning and you've thought about becoming a Christian. And the whole aspect of stepping forward and confessing that Jesus is your Lord and he's your Savior is an opportunity for you to be courageous. But God is always calling you. He's always seeking a personal relationship with each and every one of us that is personal and that's intimate. And so I ask you right now, if that's something that's prying at your heart and something you've been thinking about, here's a moment and here's an opportunity to be courageous. So I ask that if you want to make that confession of faith, to please come forward now as we stand and as we sing.